Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is the August 17th issue, after they took a week off last week and didn't print an issue. So this is week one of the August 17th issue, and I'd like to read you the cover stories. And the first cover story is The Venezuela Experiment. How a Socialist Dictatorship Became an American Protectorate. And this is by Eric Contalisa in Caracas. Delcy Rodriguez, the acting president of Venezuela, conducts the nation's business out of the Miraflores Palace, a 19th century neoclassical mansion in the heart of Caracas. Gilded portraits of Simon Bolivar and Hugo Chavez gaze down on the ornate halls. Birds chirp in the manicured gardens, and usually tight security details shadow Rodriguez's every step. The caution is understandable. Not long ago, the U.S. sent a Delta Force unit into her predecessor's residence on a nearby military base to seize the man that she had served for years. Which may explain Rodriguez's careful manner. She speaks regularly with President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, and her English is nearly flawless. But when she sits down with Time for a rare interview with an American media outlet, she summons a translator. I suggest it would be easier to speak in English. When I do interviews, I like to do them in Spanish, she says. I'm not sure that's best for this one, I say. It is best for me, she replies, with a faint smile. It's easy to understand her strategy. Speaking through an interpreter slows the conversation down and gives Rodriguez greater control over her words that ultimately reach the page. It is the instinct of a disciplined operator who has spent decades in one of the world's most unforgivable political systems and who is now navigating an extraordinary diplomatic moment. A socialist stalwart who rose through Chavez's inner circle before serving for years as Nicolas Maduro's second in command, Rodriguez was among the most recognized faces in a movement largely defined for decades by its hostility toward the United States. Today, she is the steward of a remarkable rapprochement with Washington. In exchange for United States support, she has allowed Trump and Rubio to turn Venezuela into a de facto vassal state, giving them unprecedented degree of influence over her country. In an hour-long interview, Rodriguez insists that she is not surrendering Venezuela's sovereignty, but opening the country's economy to the best interests of its people. I'm starting out by acting in good faith and insisting that these relationships can develop in good faith, she tells me. My current and future strategy has always been to ensure peace and tranquility in the country, tranquility and social and economic well-being. The nation that Rodriguez now governs is not the same country that existed before the raid that captured Maduro. Before his fall, Venezuela was in stark decline, riddled with corruption, teetering on economic collapse, and ruled by an authoritarian who the United States and independent international observers say stole his 2024 election. Hyperinflation wiped out citizens' savings. Oil production, the lifeblood of the country, had plummeted, and after years of graft, underinvestments, and sanctions, nearly 8 million Venezuelans had fled, fueling the largest migration crisis in the history of the Western Hemisphere. Rolling blackouts, water scarcity, crumbling hospitals, and shortages of food and medicine had become routine. Once among Latin America's wealthiest countries, Venezuela had devolved into one of its poorest. Since Rodriguez's ascension in January, signs of recovery have begun to emerge. Construction cranes have reappeared over parts of Caracas. Store shelves are fuller. Dormant oil fields are stirring back to life. American companies, including ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, Halliburton, and GF Vernova, have turned or begun negotiating new investments. Commercial flights between the U.S. and Venezuela have resumed for the first time since 2019. The dollar circulates openly. Foreign executives, diplomats, and investors are filling hotels. The lobby of the JW Marriott is now a gathering place for oil executives, while at the more exclusive Cayena Caracas, impeccably dressed financiers and government officials mingle amid polished marble and soft jazz, discussing exploitations, infrastructure, contracts, and Venezuela's future. All this has come at a price. Under an arrangement overseen by Rubio, the United States has become deeply involved in Venezuelan state affairs. In an arrangement described to Time by three senior U.S. and Venezuelan officials, the U.S. Secretary of State supervises the framework governing Venezuela's oil revenues and public finances, effectively administering a joint fund that gives Washington influence over everything from how the country's export earnings are allocated to the opening of energy sectors to preferential treatments to American companies. Rubio and Rodriguez are in near daily contact through phone calls and WhatsApp messages, officials say. Rodriguez consults him on domestic appointments, including her selection of a defense minister, according to three officials familiar with the arrangement. Basically, you have what they call Rodrigo's operating, says James Story, a former U.S. ambassador to Venezuela under President Trump and Biden, describing an arrangement in which Rodriguez's government remains in power while carrying out Washington's strategic priorities. They are doing everything that we ask them to do. Washington and Caracas are now operating an intelligence and counter-narcotics operation. In June, the partnership resulted in the killing of Nino Guerrero, a leader in the transnational criminal organization Tren de la Agua, at his compound in Venezuela's Bolivar State. Rodriguez says Venezuela applied the intelligence that located Guerrero and deployed forces on the ground, enabling the U.S. airstrike. The important thing is there are opportunities for joint cooperation, she tells me, against drug trafficking, for example, and against transnational organized crime. That is very important to us. Thousands of political detainees have been released under amnesty frameworks encouraged by the United States, while negotiations continue hammering out dozens of additional economic agreements. Venezuela has become a case study of Trump's ability to reshape the world in pursuit of his own priorities, inbound by the diplomatic conventions that restrained his predecessors. He launched an extra-legal campaign of force and coercion, beginning with airstrikes on suspecting drug smuggling boats and culminating in the capture of a sitting head of state who was brought to the United States to face drug and weapons charges. Maduro is now in a federal jail in New York City, replaced by a subservient successor that the Trump administration believed would comply with American interests while preserving stability in Caracas. Small and slender, dressed in tailored suits and oversized glasses, Rodriguez projected the demeanor of a technocrat rather than a firebrand. Cooperation with the United States has allowed her to consolidate power during a period of tremendous upheaval. The bargain is as brazen as it is fragile, and the leverage runs both ways. Over two decades, Rodriguez established herself as one of Chavismo's indispensable figures. There is no guarantee that another leader could sustain such an arrangement or would choose to align Venezuela with Washington rather than Beijing or Moscow. For Rodriguez, the role requires a delicate balancing act. Few Venezuelans mourn Maduro's departure after years of oppression and economic collapse. But relief at his ouster has not translated into enthusiasm for his successor. To many, she is more sellout than savior. But her future rests less on public affection than on her ability to satisfy Trump's demands and to convince citizens that becoming a client state of a despised foreign power is in the national interest. When a major earthquake struck Caracas in June, killing more than 5,000 people and causing an estimated $6.7 billion in damages, the new relationship with Washington produced dividends. The State Department assembled a $300 million reconstruction package, and the United States Southern Command provided military support for the relief effort. That the bargain can be a boon, even as Venezuela is criticized for focusing too long, even as Venezuelans criticized her for taking too long to address the catastrophe publicly, waiting 8 days before holding a press conference. Whether the arrangement will ultimately improve the lives of ordinary Venezuelans or merely enrich a privileged elite remains unclear. Rodriguez has taken few steps to institute democratic reforms. Millions of Venezuelans that want to come back are only going to do so if they are certain that their rights will be respected, says Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader who won the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize for promoting democratic rights in Venezuela and now lives in exile. To Machado, who was barred from running in Venezuela's most recent elections, Rodriguez has capitulated to Washington in pursuit of self-preservation. She's willing to give away anything that she's asked for, anything, Machado says, and that's the way that those have committed crimes reason. Rodriguez rejects the criticism. I try to ensure that another country's domestic policy does not reflect Venezuela, Rodriguez tells me. I hope that the Venezuela does not become a pawn to any other country's political agenda. As we sit in a room of polished marble and gold leaf, Rodriguez recounts the chain of events that propelled her to power with the soft, measured cadence of someone accustomed to exercising authority without raising her voice. On January 2nd, she recalls, she met with Maduro to discuss Venezuela's economic plans and the ongoing naval blockades that the U.S. had imposed since December. Afterward, she flew to Margarita Island, the Caribbean resort off Venezuela's northern coast, where her brother and nephews were vacationing. She arrived around 11 p.m., only a few hours before the frantic phone calls began. In the early hours of the morning, U.S. military units infiltrated Maduro's compound inside the Fort Tijuana military complex as he slept. They found him in his pajamas, arrested him, and whisked him and his wife out of the country. We went through a moment of great anguish when we thought that they had killed him, Rodriguez tells me. Then we learned that they were taken to the United States. That changed the situation completely. One of Rodriguez's first calls was to an unlikely figure, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, the Emir of Qatar, with whom she had cultivated a relationship. Now the responsibility rests on your shoulders, Rodriguez recalls him saying. You have a responsibility to try to preserve Venezuela. According to Rodriguez and U.S. officials, Qatar officials helped arrange a conference call between her and Rubio on the afternoon of January 3rd. Is Maduro alive? She asked. Rubio assured her that he was, and to prove it, U.S. officials sent a photograph of him in a jumpsuit aboard a helicopter en route to New York. The Secretary of State then delivered an ultimatum: meet U.S. demands or face continued military pressure. Rodriguez agreed. An aide says that she saw no viable alternative. If I'm completely honest, Rodriguez tells me, we've never thought that the capital of the country would be attacked, much less imagined what happened to the president and the first lady. She spoke to Trump for the first time that following morning. We discussed how diplomatic relations between Venezuela and the United States could be established and what areas of common interest might be identified, Rodriguez says. Trump wanted access to Venezuela's vast oil reserves, seeing them as a way to increase global supply, lower energy costs, and strengthen the United States economy ahead of the midterm elections. But he delegated the logistics to Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, for whom uprooting leftist regimes in Latin America is a long-standing priority. As Secretary of State, he suddenly had an opportunity to pursue that ambition. Under the agreement, the U.S. would receive the proceeds from most Venezuelan oil exports and then distribute the money back through Venezuela's banking system. The structure, one senior U.S. official explained, would connect like an escrow account. Washington would release funds only as Caracas met agreed upon conditions. By controlling the flow of revenue, the United States would gain leverage over how the money was spent while limiting corruption and the influence of rival foreign powers. In return, Rodriguez would remain president, buoyed by an influx of American investment and the economic benefits of renewed integration. The Trump administration saw this as a straightforward trade of political stability in exchange for economic oversight, energy access, and the strategic realignment of one of the world's most resource-rich economies. The morning a few weeks later, Rodriguez received an unexpected call from Rubio. "I'm putting you on the line with someone who wants to say hello," Rubio told her. It was Trump. According to Rodriguez, the president told her that he was pleased with her cooperation following the Maduro extraction. As a reward, he said, the U.S. would restore commercial flights to Venezuela. By April, American Airlines resumed service between Miami and Caracas. In May, United Airlines launched flights from Houston. Trump's fixation on Venezuela had grown since his return to office. He dispatched Rubio to El Salvador to broker an unprecedented agreement with President Nayib Bukele as part of Trump's mass deportation campaign. The U.S. transferred hundreds of detainees of Venezuelan immigrants to El Salvador's notorious Cicat prison during fierce criticism from human rights groups and immigrant advocates. Trump justified the move by saying that the migrants were members of the Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang that he portrayed as the embodiment of the border crisis. The situation intensified when intelligence reports alleged that indicated vessels departing Venezuela were transporting drugs toward the United States. Administration officials say Rubio and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth pressed Trump to respond with a campaign of military strikes against the alleged drug smuggling boats, according to two senior White House officials. Trump authorized the strikes, hoping military presence would compel Maduro to dismantle trafficking networks and crack down on criminal gangs, and open Venezuela's vast oil sector to American investment. When Maduro was captured, U.S. boat strikes had killed more than 100 people over the course of 10 months, according to Just Security, as of June 21st. The number of deaths has more than doubled, with 215 killed in 66 strikes. Many legal experts argue that the strikes on suspected Venezuelan drug trafficking vessels violated both international law and the limits of presidential war power under the United States Constitution. One state is only really supposed to use force against another state when that other state has committed an armed attack against or threatened imminent armed attack against it, says Scott Anderson, a former State Department official and national security law expert at the Brookings Institution. But while Trump saw a chance to secure access to Venezuela's oil reserves, Rubio saw an opportunity to make the balance of power in the Western Hemisphere balanced. Deputy White House Chief of Staff Stephen Miller soon joined the effort, increasingly eager to expand his portfolio beyond immigration into national security. He viewed the Venezuela as the point where those issues converged. Miller argued that limited military pressure would never change Maduro's calculus, a senior White House official tells Time. He pushed for a more aggressive approach, and Miller declined to comment for this story. As Rubio, Miller, and their advisors continued briefing the president on the boat strikes, they emphasized Venezuela's growing importance as a platform for American adversaries, including Cuba, Russia, and China, which had deepened their foothold through oil, military, and intelligence and economic support. The type of influence that existed in that country is compatible with United States interests, State Department official says. Senior U.S. officials were determined to change Maduro's behavior, remove him from power. Our objective was simple: persuade Maduro to sever those relationships, he says, State Department official, and he adds that he was unwilling to do that. According to the State Department official, the administration persuaded Turkey to offer Maduro safe harbor if he agreed to leave Venezuela peacefully. He refused. The inflection point was in December when we sent him an offer and he basically was, if you save the country permanently in Turkey or some other acceptable place, I'll leave you alone. But you've got to leave the country, another State Department official says. He basically ignored it. He had multiple off-ramps where he could have left and lived happily ever after somewhere else, giving us the opportunity to work with someone else inside the government to make those changes. Instead, he posted silly videos of himself dancing and singing. That someone else, Rubio believed, was Delcy Rodriguez. Rhoda Rodriguez was born into one of Venezuela's most politically connected left-wing families. Her father, Jorge Antonio Rodriguez, was a student leader of the revolutionary left movement. He was arrested, tortured, and killed by government security forces in 1976 when she was just 7 years old. His death became a defining event in her life. Alongside her older brother, Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the National Assembly, she was raised in the ideology of the Venezuelan left. Trained as a lawyer, she followed in her father's footsteps, rising through Chavez's government before becoming one of Maduro's closest confidants. She served as Venezuela's foreign minister, a role in which she became one of the regime's most combative international defenders, denouncing United States sanctions while strengthening ties with Russia, China, Iran, and Cuba. In 2018, Maduro elevated her to the vice presidency. But international diplomacy viewed Rodriguez as a technocrat rather than an ideological hardliner. She was seen as a more pragmatic figure, says Christopher Hernandez Roy, a Latin American expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. They picked her with a gun to her head, but she seemed to understand the country's economics, and she had long been deeply involved in its oil sector. That's obvious that one of the administration's highest priorities, the recovery of Venezuela's oil industry. Rodriguez had long advocated for greater economic openness. She had also been responsible for attracting foreign investments and rebuilding relationships with international energy companies. According to multiple officials, Rubio concluded that Rodriguez was a realist with a grip on the levers of government and who would be willing to meet Washington's demands. Rodriguez argues that the relationship has already reaped benefits for her country. During the Maduro years, Chevron had been the only major United States company to maintain significant presence. Now it may be joined by ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and Halliburton. U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Ferguson and Energy Secretary Chris Wright are negotiating more than 30 agreements that would give American firms a foothold in Venezuela energy sector. The most important thing is that the companies from the United States are running and arriving, Rodriguez said. The shift reflects the carrot that Trump has dangled. Renewed access to American capital and global markets. The bet is that economic integration can induce geopolitical alignment after decades of Chavista rule. It's not yet clear, though, but much of this influx of capital has reached ordinary Venezuelans. Reliable polling remains scarce under the country's authoritarian system. Venezuelans celebrated Maduro's removal in large numbers, but many remain wary of Rodriguez's views. They view her as someone who abandoned the cause to which she had devoted her political career. The Venezuelan people don't miss Maduro, right? An aide to Rubio tells Time. They fully recognize that he was a bad actor and a destabilizing influence. The oil was tremendously valuable to the people of Venezuela. It was stolen by a very corrupt group of elites and used to pay off massive debts to China, Cuba, and others. No more. To some Venezuelans, however, Rodriguez is a new face for the same regime. She spent years helping administer a government accused by international investigations of widespread human rights abuses, including arbitrary detention, torture, and extrajudicial killing. She was part of a regime that systematically violated human rights, says Diego Aria, an expert in Venezuelan politics at the Atlantic Council. She comes from a normalizing practices that are considered crimes against humanity. For all the changes underway in Venezuela, the biggest one, a transition to genuine democracy, appears distant. Rubio sees it as part of his mission to rid Latin America of its remaining socialist autocracies and lay the groundwork for Venezuela to one day build a legitimate election and complete a democratic transition, according to a State Department official. At his behest, Rodriguez's government enacted an amnesty law in February, covering political tolerance from Chavez's rise in 1999 through the present. The law includes those accused of participating in the 2000 coup attempt against Chavez and individuals complicit in violent unrest in 2014 and 2017. Venezuelan authorities say, though, that roughly 9,000 detainees have been released since the passage of the amnesty law. Rodriguez says she is prepared to have the process independently reviewed. During our interview, she says that she has asked the UN human rights officials to audit the releases, arguing that outside scrutiny will confirm the government's compliance with its commitments. But there are few signs that Venezuela is moving quickly toward free and fair elections. Trump is not focused on democratic building, says Story, the former ambassador to Caracas. If anything goes bad, increases destabilization and further erodes the chance of companies coming and making investments. That is the fear. Rodriguez expresses little urgency either. Venezuela will hold elections when it's ready, she tells me. There are extremist groups that called for military aggression against Venezuela and the Venezuelan people, especially those who experienced the attack firsthand, feel a threat and they feel a great deal of fear, she says, referring to her country's competing power center and the persistent risk of political violence. But when will that moment come? What conditions must exist before Venezuela holds open elections? I feel that moment will come when all of the country's political actors, each an understanding, and we can tell the nation that we, as politicians, are ready, she says, skirting the question. Rodriguez says that she would welcome the international election observers, provided that they respected Venezuela's sovereignty. When I ask her if she intends to run for president herself, she pauses. I don't know, she says. Then I ask the question that hangs in every discussion of Venezuela's future. Would Rodriguez allow Machado to return and compete? Rodriguez sidesteps it. We have to move on to new political era, she says. So the answer is no. My answer isn't no, she replies. My answer is that there will be a political moment when coexistence and peaceful coexistence will be possible. The answer doesn't mollify Machado. I understand the United States government decided to start with the process of stability, but in order to make that sustainable, you certainly need legitimacy, she says. They fear an election because they fear the people. They fear popular sovereignty. They know what the Venezuelan people desperately desired. Rodriguez haltingly responds to the tragic earthquake. Machado adds, exposure to the truth and the true nature of the regime and the lack of humanity, its display of infinite corruption and incompetence. For Rodriguez, everything comes back to survival. She needs to follow the guidance of the United States government, which at some point will include renewing democratic institutions and rules, says Aria. She will do it not because of her democratic commitment, but because it's a means to achieve political objectives. That would not be simply surviving politically, but creating conditions under which she and perhaps Chavismo itself can survive after power. She wants to guarantee that she, a woman whose father was killed by the state, can remain in Venezuela without fearing imprisonment or retribution from a future government. That's what survival means for her, Aria says, to make it so that the system will be stable and able to govern itself, which will potentially include her being able to participate in the new Venezuela. It is about survival. For now, Rodriguez is keen on integrating the nation into global markets and diversifying the economy, attracting long-term foreign investments and ensuring that Venezuela's prosperity no longer depends on a single commodity. The day before our interview, executives from General Electric sat across from Rodriguez discussing ways to modernize Venezuela's aging electrical grid. General Electric did not respond to a request for comment. Whether these ambitions survive Trump's presidency remains uncertain. Current U.S. foreign policy, animated by the application of leverage, economic incentives, and coercion and transactional deal-making to draw former adversaries into America's orbit, Venezuela's future will extend not only on Rodriguez's ability to manage the relationship with her current counterparts, but also on whether Trump's successor embraces the strategy or chooses another path. The interview comes to an end, and we wander through the sunlit gardens of the palace. I tell Rodriguez that I'm flying home the next day, connecting through Miami on one of the newly restored commercial flights. She smiles. Pretty soon, she says, I can skip the layover. Maybe next time, she says. We'll fly from Washington to Caracas. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds, and that was your very long cover story from this week's Time magazine. And I'd like to finish up by reading you the next story, which is The Meaning of Roots at 50. Author Alex Haley's niece reflects on the legacy left for their family and America. This is by Anne Haley. 2 days before my 39th birthday, I sat in a small boat making its way up a deep river lined with rooty mangrove trees. Though I had never been to this place, it felt hauntingly familiar, like an unlived memory. This was the River Gambia, and it was taking me to the village of Jufur. It was February 2001. 3 years earlier, President Bill Clinton had appointed my father, George W. Haley, United States Ambassador to the Republic of Gambia. Like an act of poetic atonement, America sent the great-great-great-grandson of a slave back as a diplomat to the country whence his ancestors had been kidnapped. From the first breath of Gambian air, every step felt like an introduction to my whole self. But the most extraordinary moment was when I walked into Jufur, as my uncle, Alex Haley, had done 33 years earlier on his journey to writing Roots, the saga of an American family, and discovered our beginning. As soon as the boat reached shore, I gazed onto some 36 eyes that looked like mine, many belonging to my cousins, unmet, and however many times removed, and imagined how Uncle Alex must have felt when he first set foot there. I thanked him silently for his sacrifice and perseverance. How does a single book at once condemn and captivate a nation? 50 years ago this August, Roots did just that. In 1976, the bicentennial of the United States of America, Alexander Murray Palmer Haley saw the story that he had carried since childhood, then researched and written over 12 years, sit atop the New York Times bestseller list for 46 weeks, spending 22 at number one in a Coast Guard veteran and freelance writer, had dispelled any notion of having been born in the land of the free that anthem professed, and the entire country, it seemed, was now on notice. Alex Haley was my father's older brother and a significant presence in my life. He called me his beloved niece and little Bertha, the second as a loving tribute to his mother. He flew in for ballet performances and piano recitals, sent flowers for a good report card, and bought me my first car. He delivered the commencement speech at my high school graduation and sat front and center at my college graduation and law school graduations. I adored him. And now all of these conversations around the Thanksgiving table had finally come to fruition. At 14, I innocently felt that his accomplishment was mine too. I had been raised on his story, and that was how the world that I knew. This was my family, and this was my love letter to him. Roots sold 1.5 million copies in the first 7 months, and eventually 8 million, collecting a National Book Award, a special Pulitzer Prize, and an NAACP Spring Arm Medal. It was translated into more than 35 languages and adapted into a ratings-smashing miniseries. You would be hard-pressed to find someone born in America before 1980 who does not remember a copy of Roots on the bookshelf or the miniseries playing on the TV. In his February 2nd, 1977 monologue for The Tonight Show episode on which Uncle Alex appeared, Johnny Carson remarked, "If there's anyone watching who does not know about Roots, you must have either been out of the country or on Mars someplace." But none of this had been Uncle Alex's wildest dream. All he had set out to do was to find out for himself who the African was. Uncle Alex and his brother spent most summers on their maternal grandparents' front porch. There, they would sit, rapt, listening to the stories that their grandmother, Cynthia, and her sister and their friends told late into the night. One such story told of a man brought to America on a boat from Africa that had landed in Nablus. The African name was Kinte. The African had been sold to a plantation in Spotsylvania County, Virginia, where he married the plantation cook. The two had a daughter named Kizzy, which in his native tongue meant stay put. So much more the devastating irony when she was sold to a plantation in North Carolina at 16. There, her enslaved father, her child, George, who became known as Chicken George because of his skills working gamecock fights. The stories became livelier at this point and more rich with detail. And these were characters that the women had known personally. Chicken George was Cynthia's grandfather, and they stayed with Uncle Alex. Haunted him, really. Who was this Kinte? Where was he from? There was no 23andMe then. But there were reams of microfilm at the Library of Congress and simple records in the basements of churches of Latter-day Saints. There were also, and first, Cousin Georgia. When my uncle would land in Kansas City, Kansas, where my family lived, it was like a rock star on a sold-out tour. We knew that he had come to sit at the knee of his grandmother, Cousin Georgia, decades after he'd watched her making rocking chair keep time on a porch. Now in her 80s, she was the last living repository of the stories of the African, including some of the words of his native tongue. She knew that Kambi meant river and Koro was a stringed instrument like a banjo. Since Roots was published, our country has seen an increase in Black businesses and Black academia, a Black superhero, and a Black president, even as we continue to fight the battles of institutional racism. A 2022 Pew study reported that of the Black Americans who have delved into genealogical research, 77% did so by speaking to their families. I like to think of that as a nod to Kunta, Kizzy, and the art of oral history. And folks, that does it for Time Magazine today. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.